Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear Sarah Shinlian Bynum read her story, The Burglar, from the April 11th, 2016 issue of the magazine. Bynum is the author of two novels, Madeline is Sleeping and Ms. Hempel Chronicles. She's been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 2008. Now here's Sarah Shinlian Bynum.
The Burglar. He watches the second car back out of the driveway, and then he makes a slow lap around the block, careful not to step on the cracks in the sidewalk. From other houses come the sounds of dogs barking, and from other yards the noise of lawnmowers and leaf blowers. Construction is happening somewhere down the street. After completing the lap, he looks up at the clock on top of the Catholic church the next block over, 9:40. He walks up the driveway purposefully and pushes through the white wooden gate, a high gate that, he noticed yesterday, doesn't have a lock. Ecola Orkin. Idling at the intersection, she can't remember for a moment the name of the company she is on her way home to meet. In the past week, three men came through the house, one after the other, wearing jumpsuits and slipping disposable booties over their shoes, three men on their hands and knees in the attic, creaking overhead, tapping inquisitively at the beams. After collecting all the estimates, she consulted with her husband, who had only this to say. Trust your gut. Oh, Greenleaf, that's the name. They cost the most, but she liked the man, and according to the literature, they use 100% organic materials. The husband is late to work. As the elevator carries him up to the offices, he is thinking about Emmett Byron Diggs, Attica inmate number 243. Diggs will be the first innocent man to appear on the show. When the showrunner put him on the episode, he said, "I don't want you to think that I'm asking you to write this one just because the character is black," and he replied, "I don't think that." But now he is beginning to worry about what to do with Emmett Diggs. 2,175. This she remembers exactly. After the job is done, she will write out the entire amount, and the feel of the check tearing crisply along the perforated line will be a small, silly thing that pleases her. Thank you so much. For the first time since moving into the house, she is not worrying every minute about money. She is going to the gym again. She is washing her car on a regular basis. In her clean car, in her damp gym clothes, she drives through the bright blue morning, feeling calm. She's going to be right on time. He tips back in his chair and looks at the whiteboard, where the story beats for Act One have been written in streaky black marker. They're only 2 days into breaking the episode, and already the character of Emmett Diggs is posing problems. So far, the formula has been consistent. 1960s bad guy commits heinous crimes, winds up in solitary in Attica, travels through a rift in the space-time continuum, and pops up in present-day upstate New York, where he continues his crime spree until he is tracked down and apprehended by a top-secret team of special agents, which the network says they like, which has worked just fine until now. So why, on the first episode he's been assigned to write, Are they trying something different? The backyard is a mess. Weeds up to his waist, cracked concrete. A tarp slung over a pile of stuff pushed up against the garage door. From the front, the house looked nice, neat. Green lawn, front door painted a glossy bright red. But back here, it's different. Flattened cardboard boxes, dusty grill, plastic playhouse bleaching in the sun. Shrunken lumps of shit all over the dead grass. He hesitates, then thinks of the cars that pulled out of the driveway. A Prius, a Mini Cooper. There will definitely be Apple gear inside. On one side of the board, possible backstories for Emmett Diggs. 1. Arthritic gardener's son, recently home from the army. 2. Head chef in the kitchen of local country club. 3. Member of the maintenance staff at Miss So-and-so's school. Behind each of these possibilities is the question, how does a black man in 1961 gain entry to the spaces where rich white girls live so that he can fall in love with one, get secretly engaged, and then be accused of murder when she is found dead, raped and mutilated on a golf course? Another question, asked only by the husband and only in his head. How does a science fiction guy end up writing racial melodrama? Also, how do I write this character without making him seem like all the other decent, long-suffering, wrongly accused black men who have shown up on screen over the years? Spit. Spraying across the glass, the barking sudden and loud. A black dog at the back door, lunging at him from the other side of the window in the door. It looks big, maybe 75 pounds. It looks from its light eyebrows as if it might have some Rottweiler mixed in. The door shakes when the dog launches itself, its nails scrabbling on the glass. Through the window, beyond the dog, he can see the washer and dryer. He can see sweatshirts and jackets hanging from hooks, cleaning supplies lined up along a shelf. Not too far from the back door to the shelf, the distance no more than the length of his arm outstretched. And the dog, now that he's had a minute to look at it, not as big as its bark makes it sound. At the stop sign, she counts to 5. She doesn't want to get another ticket, and then waits a little more because there's Jessica, her neighbor, out walking Coco. She gives a tap on her horn and waves, "Go ahead, cross the street." She isn't in any hurry, and she's preoccupied with a relaxing and anticipatory sort of arithmetic. How many more weeks before they can talk about getting some bids on the roof? Also, the kid needs a proper bookcase. The shelves in her room are starting to bow. The Vodersmith family is ready to graduate from Swedish Design Particle Board. They'll have to plan ahead for property taxes, due at the beginning of December, but if all goes as it should, they won't have to ask her mother for help this year. And if... is even to think it, to jinx it? Her husband is superstitious about these things. If the show gets an order for 9 more episodes, maybe they can finally tackle the backyard. We open on a couple, embracing in the dark. The grounds of a golf course roll away on all sides, the grass metallic in the moonlight. From nearby, the ticking of sprinklers, and farther off, mingled voices and the clink of silverware and glass, the warm commotion of a party. We push in on their faces, mouths locked, her skin almost ghostly against the darkness of his fingers black stripes moving through the pale waves of her hair. The kissing deepens, their bodies pressed close, she reaching up to slip from her shoulder the fragile strap of her dress, but with a single touch he stops her, his large hand over hers. Still kissing her, he cups her head lightly in his hands. Her eyes close, his open, a strangely empty stare. In an instant, his grip tightens, his arms contracting, a sudden twist, the sickening crack of bone. He's broken her fucking neck. Off his glazed look, we cut to titles. Could that work? Lenny, the story editor, glances hopefully from the showrunner to the husband to the other writers sitting loose-limbed around the table. For the teaser? Only 2 blocks away from home, she feels her sense of well-being begin to sour around the edges. She's using half a personal day for this, and that's not including the hours she spent online, clicking back and forth between company websites and sifting through contradictory user reviews, followed by even more hours imprisoned in the house, waiting for the men to show up with their slip-on booties and clipboards and brochures. In her heart, she sees Slash, the guitarist for Guns N' Roses, his pet boa constrictor draped across his bare shoulders, staring morosely at a puddle spreading at the foot of his Sub-Zero refrigerator. Years and years before, when asked by an interviewer how his life had changed since the success of Appetite for Destruction, "I got this house, and my refrigerator is leaking all over the place, and I feel comfortable just leaving it that way. But I can't do that, because this is my house." The shock of the door flying open makes the dog skitter backward, but soon enough it's on him, snarling, his shirt in its teeth, its weight pulling him down. But look who's got hold of the Windex. So there, for a streak-free shine. Right in the eyes, buddy. Who's scary now? What sort of crimes are committed by an unjustly incarcerated man who's traveled through a rift in the space-time continuum? There's not much for our team of special agents to do if Attica inmate number 243 pops up in present-day New York and spends his days being decent. Hence the episode's twist. Emmett Diggs is now a cold-blooded killer, hunting down women who resemble his dead fiancée and ritualistically murdering them in exactly the same way that she was killed on the golf course. The husband locks his gaze on the water bottle sitting in front of him so that his eyes don't start rolling involuntarily. Emmett Diggs, a saint and a predator. The husband can't look at Lenny right now, can't look at the whiteboard. He feels his insides slowly curdling. He's not going to win any NAACP Image Awards for this script, that's for sure. His first episode of network television, and he doesn't want his mom and dad to watch it. Oh, but there it is, her house, home. Eaten out of house and home, but not quite yet. Help is on the way. The termites chittering in their tiny villain voices, "Foiled again!" An upwelling of love as she turns into the driveway and sees the white gate and the red door. It's the prettiest bungalow on the block, the craftsman clabbered container of their lives. Overpriced, yes. Heavily mortgaged and termite infested, yes. But it's theirs. The feeling of 4 walls and a roof over your head, of turning a big cardboard box upside down and cutting out a hole for a window, drawing a door in magic marker, taking up residence inside. "Safe," the umpire cries. There's no van parked at the curb, no sign of Greenleaf. She's beaten them home. He backs the dog through the kitchen, then the living room, across a short hallway and into the bathroom. Not ideal, as he'd like to take a look at what's inside the medicine cabinet, but it's the only room he's encountered so far where he can close the door. Or maybe not. The latch won't hold. The door pops ajar as soon as he pushes it shut, which he does, without success, several times in a row. And now the dog is barking again, insanely. He tries once more, not slamming it, but just pressing it firmly in that careful way you have to handle old things. He pauses, counts to 3, slowly draws his hand away. The door springs open. Ridiculous. Now he's going to have to maneuver the dog out of the bathroom and into the half-furnished guest room down the hall. His Windex is ready. But seriously, a bathroom with a door that doesn't close? How do people live like that? We open on a man sauntering down a quiet block, hands in pockets, whistling "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes," just daring someone, anyone, to stop him. Can't a man enjoy a stroll through a pleasant neighborhood in the middle of the day? He pulls his large hands from the pockets of his checkered chef's pants and wishes he'd had a chance to change into something sharp. The houses gaze back at him, cool and inviting. Maybe not quite as grand as you'd expect, only 2 blocks away from the country club. But still nice, still desirable. He looks at the windows and imagines who's living inside. Who might be brushing her hair over the sink, or writing in her diary, doing stomach-flattening exercises in her underwear, leafing through a catalog, fiddling with the radio, rinsing out a juice glass, all the while a man is walking by and looking at her windows. Why shouldn't he look? It's the goddamn 21st century. There's a brother in the White House. Any one of these places, Emmett thinks, could be mine. As soon as she walks through the front door, she hears his footsteps overhead. Doug, you're still home? She wonders what could possibly make him run so late. Because won't that be noted? If he just moseys into the room after all the other writers are there? Her husband, working so hard to get this job. And now he's going to be the guy who shows up late. With the dog yelping in the guest room, he takes the stairs 2 at a time. Always start with the master is his motto. But what a corny word, motto, never to be used again, not even in his head. And it turns out to be not much of a master. The ceiling sloped, the bed unmade, the pillows strewn sloppily about. He peels a pillow out of its sham. Fuck, how does he even know that's what it's called? And uses the empty case to catch the stuff he's scooping from a jewelry box divided into a crazy-making number of small compartments. Good stuff? Bad stuff? He'll sort it out later. Digging through the dresser drawers yields nothing. Where do they keep the watches? He circles the room pointlessly, and the floor vibrates slightly beneath him as the front door slams shut. Doug? A woman's voice calls from below. You're still home? He drops the sham. Her husband doesn't answer. She goes to the bottom of the stairs and calls his name again. Is he on the phone? It could be work-related, in which case she shouldn't keep hollering in the background. She hears more footsteps and a man's voice from the bedroom. It's just us. Just the cleaning crew. Cleaning crew? Where did that come from? More like a break-in crew. Break-in crew? Ha! Break-in crew! He cracks himself up sometimes. He really does. His whole body is shaking. Break-in 2, electric boogaloo. Break-in 2, electric boogaloo. He's going to have that shit bouncing around in his head all day. Oh, hi! She is briefly confused. Did my husband let you in? He must have made it to work on time. Please let me know if you need anything, okay? She calls up the stairs. Or if you want something to drink? There's still soda left in the refrigerator from when her in-laws visited. How funny to say cleaning crew. But then again, who would want to call themselves exterminators? The phone starts ringing in the kitchen. Either her mother or the dentist's office or the music center looking for a donation. Nobody else calls on the landline anymore. From below, a robotic murmur. Beep, 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 beep. Pause. Beep, 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 beep. Fuck. Forget the master. Forget the pillow sham. Grab the laptops and go. The office is down the hall from the bedroom. Keep it simple. In and out of the office, down the stairs, through the front door, and you're gone. Hello? She picks up the handset, dropping her keys and gym bag on the counter, and notices for the first time that Misha isn't in his crate. Did Doug put him in the backyard? She's told him how many times that the dog's peeing on her tomato plants, the only things worth saving out there, and can't be left unsupervised. The woman on the other end of the line is saying that her name is Gloria. She's asking, Is this Maggie Voder at 541 North Arden Boulevard? There's Spawn, Spider-Man, Neo and Morpheus, the Crow. A really nice selection, but they've been taken out of their boxes, which is retarded, and arranged on a shelf above the computer and the desk. At least the comic books are stored properly. Long white cardboard boxes line the walls, and he knows that if he lifts a lid, he will find the books inside, bagged and boarded, organized by artist or series or year. He would like to sit on the floor for a while and see what's in there, fingering through the issues, granting or withholding his approval, losing track of time. How often has he opened one of his own boxes? Just to check on some small detail, the first appearance of a minor character, only to look up a moment later and discover that the day has disappeared. "Yes, this is Maggie," she says into the phone. She has it tucked under her ear and is wandering back to the foot of the stairs so that she can adjust the thermostat. She's still sticky from the gym and wants to turn on the air. Gloria explains that she is calling from Greenleaf, that she's very sorry for the inconvenience, but she's just spoken to the technician who's got stuck in traffic on the 101 and should be arriving at 541 North Arden Boulevard no later than... "He's already here," she tells Gloria, just as she sees him for the first time, coming down the staircase. She smiles at him. He's African American. Good for Greenleaf. The front door now seems impossibly far away. There's a woman standing at the bottom of the staircase and beaming up at him. For a moment, he can't figure out who she is. She's short, squat, sweaty, brownish, her ponytailed hair frizzing around her face. The nanny? So where's the woman who called up to him? The lady with the voice? As he inches farther down the stairs, he catches himself saying idiotically, "Just the cleaning crew," like it's the magic password that will get him safely out the door. Who does he remind her of? Oh, right, that kid from the Disney Channel who's now competing on Dancing with the Stars. The eyes wide set, the face a little too broad, the cheeks chubby, the smile ingratiating. That'll be something to tell Violet when she gets home from school. She always likes it when her mother pays attention to the Disney Channel universe. "You'll never guess," she'll say, "who he looked exactly like." Emmett pauses in front of a house that reminds him, finally, of hers. Something about the sloping lawn and the red front door, or maybe it's just the tinging of the wind chimes and the way that the mid-morning light makes the house look picture book flat. He strides up the driveway. He smooths his hair. Without hesitating, he walks across the grass and goes straight to the windows farthest on the right, where the sewing room would be. But instead of the little lace-covered table and the pedestaled fern, he sees only a mattress and box spring, a set of barbells, a bicycle, and an enormous black dog, which has risen up on its hind legs, placed its front paws on the windowsill, and is barking at him miserably. All in the same moment, she hears, from behind the guest room door, Misha barking. Why did Doug put him in there? And notices, on the man above her on the stairs, the absence of a Greenleaf uniform. Freelancer? And sees, draped across his body, a black messenger bag with the name and jazzy logo of her new employer. Hey, what a coincidence. "Just leaving now," he says, inching down the stairs. She has the exact same messenger bag, given to her only a month ago by Human Resources on the day of her new hire orientation, and containing a huge three-ring binder holding the Employee Conduct Handbook, as well as a reusable water bottle imprinted, like the bag, with her employer's logo. A bag that's remained untouched, she must confess, since she dumped it in a corner of their home office upon returning from the rather discouraging orientation. A bag that she hasn't bothered to empty, but that, she sees now, is perfectly useful. He can hear a tinny voice coming from the telephone. "Are you still there?" the voice asks, as the nanny shifts the receiver from one shoulder to the other. "Hello?" "That's my bag." The sentence comes out of her mouth before she even knows what she is saying. "That's my bag," she says again, as he squeezes past her and makes for the front door. The dog is barking. The phone is in her hand. "Where are you going?" she hears herself asking. With the other hand, she reaches out and takes hold of the strap. Everything feels both fast and slow. He's surprised by the way she asks it. "Where are you going?" Like it's a real question. Not like, "Where do you think you're going?" And not like, "You better not be going anywhere with that bag." She asks as if she weren't expecting him to leave and can't imagine where in the world he could possibly be off to. Let's see, her husband's old laptop, which Violet uses to watch movies when they fly, the external hard drive that she bought last month but still hasn't taken out of the box, her husband's off-brand noise-reducing headphones that she's been planning to replace at Christmas with a fancy pair, the real deal, all of it known to her and protruding from the messenger bag. Trying to pull away from her, he says once again, to his own amazement, "Just the cleaning crew." But she's got a good firm grip on the bag, this lady, this nanny who's turned out to be the lady. She's grabbed hold of the bag, and somehow the weight of her hand on the strap has made it surprisingly heavy. "Ma'am, can you hear me?" comes faintly from the receiver. She ignores the voice and keeps looking at the bag. She doesn't look at him, just at the bag, or maybe she's looking at him as if he's an extension of the bag or the bag is an extension of him and she is claiming both. She won't let go. All he wants to do is to get out the door and up the street and around the corner and back to his cousin's place, but this sweaty woman gripping the strap won't let him. The husband isn't hungry, but it's time now to think about lunch. The menu from the Mediterranean place is circulating around the table, along with the sign-up sheet to write down orders. He doesn't think he can do the chicken panini again. It would be the third time this month, and the pesto aioli doesn't taste as good as it used to. No more fries on the side, either. He's starting to feel like shit. At first, what had seemed like unbelievable bounty. The kitchen's always stocked with Pop-Tarts and Mexican Coke. The show buys us lunch every day. Now gives him a constant low-grade stomach ache. And fuck it, who cares if eating kale is cliche? He writes down a salad, and Lenny, at his elbow, lets out a little sigh of admiration. Lenny, plump as a partridge, who has asked on several occasions about his gym routine. "You eat smart," Lenny murmurs. "You work out smart. You're in the peak physical shape that a person can achieve." He shakes his head in wonderment as the husband hands off the menu, laughing. With the dog still barking, Emmett rounds the corner of the house and ambles along its shady side, now and then glancing into a window. What is he looking for? He's suddenly not sure. The strange sense of purpose that brought him up the driveway and across the lawn has just as mysteriously deserted him. He drifts from window to window, and a part of him understands dimly that this is not the house he is looking for, that none of them are, that the house he is looking for and the girl who lives inside it are in some profound way no longer available to him. But he persists in his orbit of the house, for lack of any other direction. He reaches up to brush a bit of spider web from his face. The hedges are full of them. And when he does so, is startled momentarily by the warmth of his own hand. Automatically, she does the math. This has become an involuntary habit. When she got that ticket at the intersection, for instance, an outrageous amount, a stomach-twisting sum, she had paid it off by the time she reached home. By adding together the early bird discount on Violet's school uniforms and the first 3 months free promotion on their cable package and the unblemished $100 bill that her great aunt still sends her every year on her birthday, she'd made the ticket disappear. Ta-da! And now, hanging on for dear life to the strap of her messenger bag, she takes one look at the belongings shoved inside and immediately assesses the damage as minimal. $250, tops. She can make that go away, no problem. Okay, Lenny says, squinting at the board. Okay, okay, okay. When he pitches, he can say up to a dozen okays in a row without even noticing before he gets his first real word out. Okay, so we start with a dead girl on the golf course, right? And the next morning, our guys, when they see the way her body is arranged, he quickly contorts himself to illustrate. They know this has got to be one of theirs. The cervical fracture, the pattern of lacerations, it all matches the profile. But they're confused, right? Because they have the benefit of hindsight. They know that the only thing Emmett Diggs was guilty of was being a black man who dared to love a white woman in 1961. He takes a gulp of air. So what they can't figure out is who butchered the blonde lying next to the eighth hole. They spend the first two acts chasing down bad leads while Diggs stalks and seduces and kills one beautiful young victim after another. The husband interrupts. Lenny. He tries to find the easy tone he uses when giving the kid workout advice. This direction we're going in. From inside the house, he thinks he hears movement, voices, a conversation. There's someone in there besides the barking dog, and the thought obscurely comforts him. He isn't alone, after all. He has somewhere to go now, someone to find. But he cannot summon up his whistling bravado from before. He is still hesitant and uneasy, and as he edges his way closer to the back steps, he wishes he had a better idea of what he is supposed to do. It doesn't make sense to me. If you were Emmett Diggs and you'd been rotting away in Attica, wrongly convicted for murdering the love of your life, tormented by the prison guards, and then, after being thrown into solitary yet again for something you didn't do, you suddenly find yourself free and at large and 50 years into the future, your first impulse is to go pick up women at the nearest country club? That sounds more sarcastic than he wants it to. He needs to go slow. I mean, wouldn't Diggs want to exonerate himself? He'd want justice. But who is he kidding? That's not the kind of show he's riding on. Actually, vengeance. He wants to avenge her death. He's hunting down the real killer, whoever it was who murdered his fiancée and framed him for it. Lenny is nodding rapidly as if completely convinced, but then asks politely, "Maybe that's a more familiar take on it?" The co-executive producer agrees. "I feel like I've already seen that a million times." The showrunner gives him an encouraging smile. "We're trying to do something different here," he explains. "Our mandate is to be edgy, to push the envelope." She doesn't want to let go of the bag. Despite knowing what the contents are and of how little value, despite being aware that there's nothing inside the bag that she wants or needs or even really likes, she won't let go. A treacherous thought occurs to her, unbidden. Her husband must in some way be at fault. It all makes sense. He forgot to lock the door when he left for work that morning, which is why some guy, some stranger, was able to waltz into their house and have a look around and help himself to a bagful of their stuff. And now, like everything else concerning the house, she's going to have to take care of it. How dare he? Just one more pushy person trying to take advantage of her. The contractors with their ridiculous bids, the Korean dad in the Lexus who has twice cut her off in the carpool lane at school. Don't even get her started on Anne-Marie, the simpering but secretly ruthless head of HR who managed to chisel away at her salary requirements until she was left with a comprehensive vision plan and 3 weeks vacation while basically working for free. Well, enough is enough. They're not going to get away with it. She's sick. and she's tired and she's not going to take it anymore. Where has she heard that before? Somehow nothing in this moment feels entirely her own, from the words in her head to the sneakers braced on the floor to the hand that is holding so tightly to the bag strapped across the man's body. He's running out of time. He's only a few feet away from the front door. "Let go," he tells her, in a voice he doesn't quite recognize. Hopefully it sounds deep and forceful. He's not even sure she's heard him. Her grip is still strong, but her face has gone sort of blank. The husband focuses on his breath, takes a second to regroup. He smiles back at the showrunner. "Okay," he says. "Okay." He's starting to sound like Lenny, for God's sake. "I guess I understand why, for purposes of edginess, we want Emmett Diggs to be killing white women. But what's still unanswered for me is how he becomes a killer in the first place. How does a man start out perfectly innocent and then turn into a person who's capable of murdering someone?" Just as he is wondering how he will get inside, Emmett discovers that the back door is already open for him. And not just open, in fact, but missing. The back door is lying on the pantry floor, wrenched from its hinges, and if he's not careless, he can walk right through the doorframe without getting splinters caught on the sleeve of his jacket. She's showing no sign of letting go. "I have a gun," he tells her, no longer caring about his voice, and reaches behind his back to draw it from the waistband of his pants. "Ha! Does she look stupid? Not just nice, but stupid?" He makes a big show of going for his so-called gun, and when he lifts his arm to reach behind him, she sees for the first time the tattoo running the length of his forearm, a long, dark tattoo that looks as if it might be a blade or a sword, extending from the inside of his elbow to his wrist, a tribal-looking tattoo, abstract and arty, the sort of tattoo you'd find on someone working in a cheese shop. The husband almost laughs at the stupidity of his own question. As soon as it's out of his mouth, he's already thinking, let's see, where to begin? The legacy of Jim Crow? Mass incarceration? The criminal justice system? Police brutality? Underemployment? White flight? Redlining? Profiling? Misrepresentation in the mass media? His first episode of network television. At least 4 or 5 million viewers will be tuning in. His first episode of network television. A weekly paycheck larger than he's ever seen. Green envelopes with residual payments inside. Writers Guild health insurance for his wife and kid. His first episode of network television. And he doesn't want his mother and father to watch it. "I have a gun." Emmett can hear more clearly now that he's inside the house. And emerging from the kitchen into the living room, he sees them. And he thinks at first that they're dancing together. Or maybe the boy is helping the woman lift something small but heavy. Their bodies are that kind of close. Her back is toward him, so that when the boy raises his fist, he can't see what's happening on her face, but he can see the boy's face, and like a mirror, it reflects his own bewilderment. The face asks, "What am I doing here?" She was right, there is no gun. She knew it. Just as she knows that this whole big wind-up with his arm is silly. Pow! Right in the kisser! He can wave his fist around all he wants. See how he lets it hang there in mid-air, giving her an even better view of his tattoo. Nice try. He gets points for dramatic effect. Bang! Zoom! To the moon, Alice! She knows he's not going to do it. Something is required of him in this moment, he knows. Someone is scared and needs his help. What's confusing is the question of who. Even though the boy is looming over her and has his fist cocked, they both look to him like they're in trouble. Arm raised, hand clenched, he sees it then clearly. She thinks he's a joke. He sees it in the stubborn way she holds her body, the blank look, the total absence of fear. He's a lightweight. Joker, he's not going to do it. Actually, he thinks, yes, I am. Bam! Pow! Right in the eye. She stumbles backward, nearly falling on her butt, letting go of the bag. Lenny brightens. Actually, I've been thinking about that. And here's where we can introduce some really dark, interesting stuff in the B story. You've seen the Manchurian Candidate, right? Okay, so what I'm thinking is the warden has been doing some crazy psychological experiments on the inmates, including Emmett Diggs. They've made him into an assassin, and he doesn't even know it, using, you know, radical brainwashing techniques, like a mixture of what they do in A Clockwork Orange, plus electric shock therapy, plus hypnosis. So what we come to realize is what triggers him is white women. Abruptly, the husband pushes away from the table, his chair squealing against the floor. He stands, rising to his full height, the sight of which makes Lenny pause and shoot a quick glance at the showrunner. "Everything okay, buddy?" the showrunner asks. The husband looks at him evenly. "Yes," he says. "I'm just getting a Coke." There's more blood than he expected. The lady is holding her eye with the hand that was on the messenger bag, and he can see blood coming through her fingers. In her other hand, she's still holding the telephone. The person on the other end seems to have finally hung up. The husband walks right past the office kitchen and keeps heading down the hallway until he arrives at the elevator, which he takes to the lobby. After nodding at the security guard, he pushes through the glass doors. He stands on the empty sidewalk, squinting in the sunlight, barely registering the traffic going by. Then he slowly rotates to face the building. The security guard moves to open the door for him, but the husband shakes his head, pulls his car keys from his pocket, and turns toward the parking garage. The only place he wants to go right now is home. Emmett hangs back for a moment, surveying the scene. On one hand, he wants to go to the woman, who is sobbing in disbelief and dripping blood on the floor. But even though he has no way of knowing that a very good plastic surgeon will sew up her eyebrow with 22 stitches, or that her husband, despite his first show being canceled, will go on to write for a relatively popular supernatural police procedural, or that the woman, upon being asked by a female officer as they load her into the ambulance, "Now, were you in any other way assaulted?" will feel for the first time afraid, or that the dog, after attacking a UPS delivery driver, will be taken to a rescue organization up north that specializes in Australian shepherds, or that the daughter, having been told that her mother tripped at the gym and split her eyebrow open on a barbell, will grow nervous whenever the woman puts on exercise clothes. He somehow senses that regardless of the blood and tears, his attention should be focused elsewhere. The sound of the front door opening softly makes him look at the boy. A little heavyset, still wearing the satchel slung over his shoulder. But before he can cross the room and reach him, before he can open his mouth and say, "Hey, brother," the boy has closed the door behind him and is gone.
That was Sarah Shunlian Bynum reading her story, The Burglar. Bynum's story, The Earl King, was included in The New Yorker's 20 Under 40 issue in 2010. She teaches creative writing at Otis College of Art and Design in Los Angeles. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. If you enjoyed this program, you may also enjoy the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, which features New Yorker fiction writers reading and discussing stories from the magazine's archive. This month, Anne Enright reads Frank O'Connor's The Masculine Principle. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Author's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Author's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.